Radio Netherlands, the home of high frequency since 1927.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, a weekly survey of communication developments hosted by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and we'll start this week's trip into the world of wireless with a letter from Dave Taylor, who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA. He says that a few weeks ago in his local newspaper, he noted reports that with the reunification of Germany, the level of US forces stationed in that country was going to be reduced. The question, what effect, if any, will this have on the huge American forces network of radio and television stations in Northern Europe? Well, it seems there may well be some moves. Paul van Dijk is Programme Director of AFN Europe and Chief of Operations at the headquarters in Frankfurt.
That's true, and we get into an area of politics of which I'm not an expert, but anybody who's planning for the future, and we are planning for the future, realizes that the U.S. forces in Europe will indeed become smaller. We don't have a magic matrix that will allow us to say, if we only have X amount of soldiers in Europe, we only need X amount of broadcasters. Because I would remind you, we have a network in Italy that's almost as large as AFN, serving far fewer people, as we do in Korea. So our size will be determined by how many different locations we have to serve, not necessarily the size of those audiences. Because in a place like Kaiserslautern, where we serve anywhere around 120,000, 130,000 people, that's larger than the rest of the military in Korea or in Italy. So we don't determine it by size. The levels of service determine that. We are indeed planning on closing some of our stations. We don't know which ones yet, with the exception of Munich. The city of Munich was deemed as a closure. All U.S. forces personnel are beginning to move out. We will conclude our broadcasting on 1 April 1992 in Munich. And that's the oldest AFN station. That's the one that first went on the air. So we'll say an old soldier will retire in April of 1992.
Newcomers Briefing is a mandatory bi-monthly orientation held on the last Tuesday every second month. Briefing will ease you into your new surroundings and acquaint you with some of what Munich offers. For more information about the Munich Newcomers Briefing, call Munich Military 440-6444 or civilian 6229-6444. 806, good morning. 11 spoonful for AF in Munich.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty.
The closure of AFN Munich will certainly mark a milestone in military broadcasting history here in Europe. Veteran broadcaster Roy Neal was program manager at AFN Munich in the early days after the end of the Second World War. Hitler's German Reich had set up an ingenious system of broadcast lines across the country, linking studios in Berlin to transmitters all over the place. So did they simply hand things over to the Allies?
Not really, because what happened, of course, the Germans weren't about to sit there and share their secrets, but a few of them were. Inevitably, there was always the telltale, usually an 18- or 19-year-old boy who didn't give a damn about the Reich anymore and did give a darn about his hide. And through them, we found most of the broadcast circuits. We also found marvelous things like Rolls-Royce automobiles that had been buried to keep them from the Allies. And in terms of German equipment, we not only found their transmitters, we found the most magnificent thing of them all, magnetic tape recording. We uncovered the two doctors with their magnetophones. These were the original tape recorders. And they came along with the magnetophones and made them work. And through Armed Forces Radio Service, immediately following World War II, we suddenly made the world conscious of the fact that magnetic tape recording is a great way to go. Nazi propaganda stemmed from Berlin. It was easily controllable from there. And what they did was feed from their Berlin studios through the landlines, broadcast circuits, incidentally. Class A circuits is what we would have called them in the broadcast business. They'd feed that down the line, and then the transmitters were moved around like chessmen on a chessboard, and they'd come up at different points each night, never long enough in a single locale to vector in and bomb out the spots. And of course, it's very hard to bomb a culvert, a concrete stop in the line, as it were. We did an interesting experiment, by the way, at a later date. We, in this case, the American Forces Network of the Armed Forces Radio Service, we were making some tremendous strides out of AFN Munich. It was putting through marvelous signals worldwide, and particularly throughout all of Europe, we were getting a tremendous audience. And we had such a large audience in France that by referendum vote, 70% of the population preferred us to Radio Diffusion Française. So we couldn't close the stations down. And instead we thought, gee, what a neat idea if we were to take another station, perhaps another one of these 100-kilowatt transmitters, put it over in Stuttgart and put the two of them on the air in tandem on the same frequency. Well, need I add, because you're in the broadcasting business, Jonathan, that what happens is that signals, unfortunately, don't propagate quite the same way at the same time. And so you began getting a phase relationship such that they would destroy one another coming out at night, especially when the sun went down.
At that time, broadcast transmitters were also used as navigation beacons. One morning, Roy Neal got a call from an irate colonel who told him that their private scheme of coupling the transmitters had resulted in an emergency landing.
They just hit, they what? Yes, they were using AFN Munich as their basing station, and they were using that for navigation, and they just hit a mountain in Stuttgart. What are you people doing? And suddenly I realized they had been, if you will, following the beam, coming in on the beam, and this beam led them into a mountain in Stuttgart instead of to AFN Munich's nice transmitter down on the flatlands.
And this was high-power AM, is it?
High-powered AM. And it's still used in many parts of the world as a good way in which to locate as a beam locator.
Some of the settings for the studios were straight out of a storybook. Take the castle setting for AFN Frankfurt.
That was my first job with AFN. I was brought into the network and sent, dispatched immediately to Frankfurt. Actually to Herxt, the small town of Herxt am Main, which is a suburb of Frankfurt. There, they had stumbled across a castle owned by Otto von Brüning, who had been a Reich minister. Not a Nazi, by the way. But he owned these castles, and they were on a magnificent property, and one of them had been built, somewhere around the 13th century, and the other had been built long even before that. The other one was really ancient. It had dungeons down in the basement with devils on them and so forth. And my first job with AFN was to go in and turn that into a broadcasting station, which we did. As a matter of fact, I'll never forget the day that they destroyed what had been the ballroom with a magnificent crystal chandelier, that they, in this case, were army engineers with hatchets who went in there and chopped down that magnificent crystal chandelier and then covered the walls for me with Wehrmacht blankets so that we could get some acoustics in the studio that we could use. And what had been the ballroom of the von Brüning Castle became Studio A. Their chapel, by the way, became the bar.
Mind you, the Americans weren't the only allies active in the broadcast business. British Forces Network, the forerunner of today's BFBS, as well as the British Broadcasting Corporation, were active up in Hamburg, northern Germany. Did the British and Americans ever work together?
The answer to your question is no. We did this as, if you will, the American Forces Network of the Armed Forces Radio Service, an American or GI operation. However, when you have a good broadcast facility, you share the facility. Jonathan, you know very well that you and your operations can on occasion share from American broadcasters too. We do this as an international gesture, more of goodwill, but more than that, it is the kind of cooperation that we expect and that we willingly give. Well, on one occasion, we had somebody there from the BBC. I've forgotten his name, but I do know that at the time, one of the things that was not very plentiful for our troops was whiskey. We could get all the wine, all the brandy, but you couldn't get whiskey. And so this fellow had enjoyed working out of our studios. He had enjoyed our mess hall and all the rest of it. And as he left, he says, I say, is there anything I can do for you? And we said, well, yeah, there is, as a matter of fact. You can get some whiskey for us if you can find any. He said, oh, very well, how much can you use? Whatever you can send. Oh, about a month later, a sergeant came into me, and at the time I was station managing still at the station. And, sir, we have a problem. I said, oh, what's the problem? Sir, we owe $10,000. I said, what for? He says, there's a railroad car full of Scotch whiskey down on the siding. It's just been delivered. A railroad car? How much Scotch whiskey's down there? He said, a railroad car full, sir. $10,000, sir. I said, what are we paying for a bottle? He says, I think it's either 75 cents or a dollar a bottle, sir. Now, at that time, you must remember, this is post-World War II, so the dollar was worth a lot more in that era. But whiskey was still whiskey, and at that time, good Scotch whiskey, and this was of the best. Good Scotch whiskey was selling, even in the cheapest of bars, at something like $4 or $5. And I said, tell you what you do, Sergeant. First of all, you get on the phone. We're now selling Scotch whiskey. We'll sell it to anybody that wants it, as much as they want, at $5 a bottle. If you can't get five, go for $3.50. As soon as you have sold enough bottles of whiskey to cover the bill, go down there, pay the bill, and bring back the rest. To make a long story a little shorter, we wound up with, so help me, a half a railroad car full of Scotch whiskey, fully paid for, and that was the gratitude of the BBC to AFN for a little service from the studios.
Congratulations, volunteer Karen Crawford of the Bobenhausen Military Community. Another Desert Star.
Serving the United States European Command, this is AFN.
It's 9 o'clock in Central Europe.
But what about the current situation in Germany and the Benelux? Paul van Dyk again.
Well, the current figures, and the current figures do change. We list about 600,000 U.S. Forces personnel and their family members and Department of the Army, Air Force civilians that are stationed here in the EUCOM area.
And is it just radio?
No, we have radio, both AM and FM service, and we have television. We do this through 10 affiliate locations in Germany, in what was West Berlin, now Berlin, Holland, and in Belgium. We don't have the same services in all locations. We have about 50 transmitters throughout those locations carrying radio, and we have about 110 transmitting locations carrying television.
Robert Harlan was the man in charge of AFN Europe in Frankfurt when television started.
Television became a part of the AFN mission back in 1973. Actually, television began in Germany back in 1956 as a responsibility of the U.S. Air Force, which decided that the very remote, isolated air bases up in the Eifel Mountains near Spangdahlem and Bitburg and Ramstein should have the advantage of television in order to provide some contemporary information and entertainment programs and contribute to the morale and welfare of the forces who were isolated areas. Television naturally became very popular and grew, and the transmission system expanded, and largely a larger army audience developed. And finally, in 1973, the Department of Defense discovered that it had more army viewers than it did Air Force, and so it assigned the responsibility for television operations to AFN Radio. So on the 1st of July, 1973, AFN Radio, which had prior to that been radio only, became radio and television. And we continued to operate and supervise television operations out of the Air Force studio in Ramstein, Germany, until this building could be modified, renovated, and be properly prepared to accept a television mission, which finally occurred in October of 1976, when we went on the air for the first time with color television. Everything prior to that had been black and white.
State 56, 4 minutes away from 9 o'clock. Jan Wood's got news up at the top of the hour. I'm Specialist John Hampton. That's going to do it for AM Edition. You take care of yourself. I'll be back here on Monday, dark and ugly at 5. You take care. Have a safe weekend. Don't drink and drive. Bye-bye.
Should have been gone. No. Made you feel and I should have been gone.
Which begs the question, which is more important in the 1990s? After all, television is becoming easier to transport around the continent thanks to all the satellite capacity.
That's a question like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's also in the ear of the listener. Radio for us is undoubtedly the most important thing we do because it's portable. Radio travels with a soldier when he's in the field. It travels in his car. It travels with him at home. So we have a way of conveying information and news all the time. Television being a fixed medium, it's very difficult for it to be portable. However, when a family sits around in the evening, our guess is television becomes more important to them.
Now, recently in the Operation Desert Storm, I understand the troops stationed here also went out to Saudi Arabia. Is that correct?
That is correct. Now, we were not the network in Saudi Arabia. The Department of Defense put a network in there. However, some of our people went there to support it and did indeed spend several months in Saudi Arabia with us part of that network. And we dispatched reporters down to do radio and television news, interviews, features that we brought back to Germany to play back for the audience here because we had a unique situation. This is the first time in modern history that a forward-deployed army, which our army is, it's deployed for combat here in Europe, actually redeployed to another theater, leaving their families in a contested area, if you will. So we were put in a unique position of having to support family members much heavier than we'd done in the past.
This is 873 AM, Power Radio on AFN. Weather-wise today, look for cloudy skies, rain showers possible in the Frankfurt region. High expected near 63 degrees today. Low tonight near 55. Weather comes from Detachment 25, 31st Weather Squadron at Rhein-Main Air Base. Currently, our temperature is 55 degrees. That's 55 degrees from Power Radio.
Sexual dissatisfaction at home is not the main reason that most women start having affairs.
If we really said what we were here for, we're here to provide information for U.S. Forces personnel stationed in Europe, music is one of the methods we use to convey that information. Naturally, without music, we would be missing heavily on the entertainment side. But we are experimenting with all kinds of radio here. We have a more music format on FM, and we have a more information programming on AM. As a matter of fact, we're experimenting considerably on AM, bringing a new style of radio to Europe that you don't see too much here, or hear too much here, but you hear a lot of it in the States. That's talk radio. In the morning hours here on AM radio, we do primarily a talk morning format, news and information.
And public information spots. I mean, instead of carrying the commercials that you'd hear on an American station, I know there's lots of spots about healthcare and so forth.
That's correct. If you were in the United States or in England or wherever they're doing commercials, you'd be selling cars. You'd be selling furniture. We are selling ideas. We're selling information. What we're doing is we're supplying information about what's happening in dental clinics, what's happening with health care, what's happening with new military regulations. And we try to package that information exactly the same way we would package information in States and call it a commercial. We use sell techniques, we use a touch-and-getting techniques, and we use the sell technique to get the information across.
Now, you're not in military uniform. Does that say something about how AFN is run?
Well, I'm a civilian, of course. That's why I'm not in uniform. AFN is a military organization. It's commanded by an Army colonel, and it's run exactly as any military organization would be, except for the fact we have civilian managers in certain parts of the operation, and we have civilian producers. And their primary purpose here is to provide a bridge, if you will, a retainability of information and experience. So as the military rotates in and out of Europe, this experience level remains, and it's taught and passed on to new people.
Now, I know that here you're calling it AFN. The network, I think, worldwide is called the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service. It used to be called the American, too. Why did they change the name?
Okay, that one's one that changes once in a while. AFN has always been the American Forces Network ever since the day it was founded. The Armed Forces Radio and Television Service is a DOD operation. It runs out of Washington, D.C. Its headquarters is a thing called the American Forces Information Service. A few years ago, they changed the title of AFRTS to the American Forces Radio and Television Service. And the AFRTS Armed Forces Radio had been such an identifiable thing. Eventually, they went back and began calling themselves Armed Forces Radio and Television Service again.
Hey, I'm Adrian Kronauer. I'm on again at 1600. Why? Because I have to. It's the Army. We're talking out the field today. Hi, what's your name?
My name's Bob Fibber.
Bob, what do you do?
I'm in artillery.
Thank you, Bob. Can we play anything for you?
Anything! Just play it loud, okay?
You may wonder to what extent the film Good Morning Vietnam, released a couple of years ago, harmed or helped the image of U.S. military broadcasting abroad.
Well, I don't think it either helped or harmed us. What happened with that movie is it made perhaps an awareness factor amongst a large number of people who had never heard of AFRTS in the United States, or many, many people who've never been in the Army or Air Force. They've never been necessarily in an overseas theater where there is an AFRTS. So we got some good exposure, but it was a mythical film based on a set of circumstances which were not necessarily true. They happened in an environment which was a true environment, which AFVN operated under. So it's made an awareness, and it hasn't done us any harm.
But it wasn't correct in the sense that there was one super disc jockey who was very offbeat and the rest was, well, rather boring and turgid.
Well, in the history of AFRTS, and I've only been with it since 1958, and I have been in Korea and in Vietnam and here, there really isn't a super anybody in AFRTS. It's a bunch of people working together. There are degrees of talent, of course, and there's always a star of some kind, but not of the magnitude that the movie made. But if you really stop to realize, the Kronauer story was not so much about AFVN as it was about him and his personal experiences in Vietnam. So you'd have to talk to him about the accuracy of the information.
And as far as the film was concerned, very much written around Robin Williams.
That is correct. It was showcasing his talent. I don't know any disc jockeys who come across as well as he did with all that talent.
Nowadays, if you tune into AFN and many of the bases, you'll actually find two stations, one on AM, the other on FM. Both were separate programming.
In the time AFN received FM many, many years ago in the 60s, FM was an additional service, and it was run primarily by automation. Over the years, we've long desired the possibility of splitting that up and doing separate programming. Manpower being an issue, we weren't able to do that. But as we were able to do more networking in Europe, all of a sudden it became possible that we could do an FM service in Frankfurt that could indeed be broadcast in other locations. So we started experimenting and trying to determine where we'd like to go with FM. AFN has always been known as a service that provided something for everybody, ran pretty much the middle of the road in its programming because our audience is so diverse. When we looked at FM, we said, we'll try to aim our programming here at a younger element of our audience. So we did some research on what age groups we should look for. We did some research on what kind of music would be best for those age groups. And we spotted a format in America called Z-Rock. So we went for Z-Rock, and it was primarily a rock and roll-based format. And it was certainly different than anything we had on AM radio, and it became an instant success.
When you say it's a network, does that mean to say that everything is indeed coming out of Frankfurt and feeding, let's say, the satellite stations like AFN in Susseberg or AFN in Shape?
We indeed can program from Frankfurt now. The music can come from Frankfurt, and for the most part does come from Frankfurt. We have five locations that are carrying the Z service. But we've taken our Z-Rock and we've modified it a little bit, and it's not quite as wild on the rock and roll side. We've gone more toward classic and gold, because we found our audience prefers classic and gold. Start with something they remember, end the program with something they remember, and they'll come back after the newscast. And it's been successful, but our distribution system now is such we have a domestic satellite. We can distribute that FM service throughout Europe. And as I said, we have it in five locations. We plan to expand it.
The most music and the best mix. ZFM.
We're really here to serve U.S. Forces personnel. It's not that we want to be exclusive. That is the sole reason that I get paid. That's the sole reason AFN is here. So we've designed our service all along to reach those audiences. It was never intended to deny it to anybody for any particular reason, political or economic. That's just the way the service was designed. Also, it wasn't an issue with us in the 1940s because we didn't have television. We also took over some existing facilities, and the power of those transmitters just happened to be there. As television came into the arena in the 70s, we ran into something that we had never dealt with before. We acquired television from the Air Force, and they had been broadcasting at a modified PAL standard. This standard had been put in for several reasons. They had audio in NTSC and video in PAL. It kept what was known as a shadow audience from watching Air Force television. And it wasn't a matter of denying anybody that. It was a matter of copyright. AFRTS acquires these programs at a very, very, very low rate, a very low fee. That fee is primarily administrative. So we own no rights to the program. We have no rights to the program except the short U.S. Forces personnel. So when we moved to Frankfurt in 1976 and moved television here, we went to a total NTSC standard. All of our transmitters, or virtually all of them, are very low powered. We broadcast on transmitters of 5 watts. 5 watts won't light up a light bulb if you're very far away from it, but it's designed just to serve a local area. There are many multiple standard sets in Europe. Many Europeans can't see us. We have no idea how many it is. We don't run a survey because that isn't our business. We do survey our primary audience. And as we have expanded in Europe, we have kept our power very low.
Final question. That was the last time I was here. I think it was in the basement. I saw a huge collection of old radio shows from the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Is that still here?
We still have it. AFN, to my knowledge, has the only complete record library in AFRTS. We have discs that were issued in 1944-45. We have the very first P1 disc issued by FRTS. We have recently been retiring some of our programs. You would have to be a real radio fan to go back to things like Jill's Jukebox, The Shadow, Gangbusters. These old radio programs, we have been offering them to the Library of Congress. I'm sorry, the Smithsonian. And they have been accepting them. We've been creating them back. But we've kept most of the shows. We keep 5 to 10 samples. So downstairs, we have a sample of all those programs. But we have all the music records ever listed there in our library now.
And are they used?
Well, AFN today is a primarily a modern radio station, like any modern radio station. It's used for archival purposes only. Those records are seldom ever played unless we're doing a documentary or something that requires that kind of music, or somebody really wants to hear what a singer from the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s sounded like. Other than that, that music is never used. Virtually all of our music today is on CD. We're very modern, just like everybody else. Records are pretty much a thing of the past. They stay in the library unless we need them.
Curiously, although U.S. forces are stationed in the United Kingdom, they're not served by low-power AM or FM transmitters as in the rest of Europe. That situation seems to date back to the war years, when the BBC was keen to put restrictions on the American broadcasters. After all, their style of presentation was very different to the formal style of the BBC. In fact, it was more like the pre-war sounds of commercial radio that had been beamed towards Britain from northern France.
During the build-up toward D-Day, BBC feared the competition of American broadcasters. And well, they might, because what was being delivered from the American broadcasters was commercial-free. They stripped the commercials and turned out all the magnificent programs of the time, the Bing Crosbys, the Fred Allens, the Jack Bennies, all with no commercials. So, of course, it was tough competition. I think nobody in the world could have stood up against it. But the BBC was pretty smart. They, after all, were a government-owned service, and they, in this case, had to maintain their integrity. So they insisted that Armed Forces Radio for the United States to service its troops could have no more than 50 watts of AM power. 50 watts. And they could have an antenna height of, as I remember it, it had to be a horizontal antenna and no more than, I think, 15 or 20 feet above the ground. To service, in other words, a troop distribution, but not enough to get out of the immediate area.
And this was for transmitters placed where?
Placed at all of the build-up areas for all of the American troops in England preparing for D-Day. This was precisely what Armed Forces Radio was trying to cater to with American broadcasts to make them feel a little more at home, and the BBC was protecting its turf in their country while this was going on. Now, once D-Day had been accomplished, those troops went on into the continent, and that's when AFRS started using the higher power transmitters and getting out to the troops in the field, and the 50-watt transmitters wound up being our stock. We had a stock room full of these darn things. I had a few of them, and I adapted them to the amateur 75-meter band. They worked very nicely, by the way.
I wonder if any survive. The voice there of Roy Neal, and my thanks to Robert Harlan and Paul van Dyk for their help in that profile.
Thanks to Media Network contributors worldwide for another edition of the program. No thanks to the ionosphere.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.